It's been 22 years since the summer that changed baseball forever. The great home run chase between Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa. It was a season that made fans fall in love with the national pastime again after the strike of 1994 threatened to turn off an entire generation to the game. Now, with baseball again on the brink, ESPN insider Buster Olney joins us to shed light on whether we could be looking at another lost year, then takes us back to 1998, a season that looks more complicated in hindsight, but may have saved the game nonetheless. I'm Ina Kimes. It's Friday, June 12th. This is ESPN Daily, presented by Marathon. Hey, Buster.
Hey, Mina.
Buster Olney is the host of ESPN's Baseball Tonight podcast and has been covering MLB for nearly three decades. Buster, are you getting stopped on the street now and asking, okay, is baseball coming back?
I'm getting texts, I'm getting emails, not only from like neighbors or friends, but it's players.
Huh.
Like how many players are reaching out and saying, what do you hear? And getting a lot of that and certainly a lot of anxiety from people because of how long this has dragged on.
Well, I want to talk to you today about the upcoming 30 for 30 Long Gone Summer, which premieres this Sunday. It's about the 1998 home run chase between Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa. But first, I, like the players who are texting you, do want to ask you about baseball in 2020, because Commissioner Rob Manfred said unequivocally that they will play Major League Baseball this season. Do you believe him?
I do believe him, but I would say this. The worst case scenario for Major League Baseball as a product is no games whatsoever. The second worst case scenario is Rob Manfred, Major League Baseball, ramming a short season down the throats of the players. Because I've had agents tell me, if you try to foist a system on the players that they haven't agreed to and there hasn't been any cooperation or collaboration, you're going to see some players say, I'm not going to participate. You might see some players, and we know that during the course of a typical season, a lot of them will play through nagging injuries. Some of them may not do that. You might see relief pitchers saying, I'm going to protect my interests. Since you guys are protecting your interests, I'm not pitching more than one day in a row. I can't tell you exactly what form all that would take place, Mina, but I think it would become an absolute circus.
How much closer do you think we are than a week ago?
Well, I think they're close to a resolution with the proposals going back and forth. And let's face it, you know, neither one has really made any major concession. But based on what Rob said, based on when the calendar is, based on the fact that Major League Baseball does want to have whatever form of regular season ended by September 27th, they're kind of on the clock. I think that they really should have gotten a deal done three weeks ago, but I do think that there needs to be resolution the next week, and I think Major League Baseball will do that.
If they were to not come to a resolution, and this is something you've written about before, how bad would it be for the sport?
Terrible. Absolutely. And here's the thing. Even if, let's say, they did actually collaborate and cooperate and come up with something, they've already, I think, absolutely committed so much damage to the product together that it may not recover for years. Because let's face it, as we sit here today, they've missed the opportunity to own the sporting stage in this country for at least a couple weeks in July. And on top of that, they've angered so many fans with the way this has played out publicly with this spat over money. And we've seen that from both sides contributing to that. You know, last week when Tom Ricketts, the chairman of the Cubs, was coming out and talking about how, well, it doesn't make as much cash as what people realize, I was just thinking to myself, there are more than 40 million people out of jobs. So many people have lost their lives. And since George Floyd was killed, everything going on in this country, and you have a billionaire talking about his cash flow problem. You talk about tone deaf, but that continues.
Well, that brings us back to Long Gone Summer and the home run race of 1998. Because Buster, as you know, the story really began during the strike of 1994, which turned off a lot of baseball fans to the sport. For those who don't remember, how bad was it?
It was really bad. I remember the first games in the 95 season after the two sides resolved that labor strife, seeing so many empty seats. That year, attendance was down about 20%. TV ratings were down. And that labor stoppage really began the demise of the Montreal Expos. That franchise never recovered. It would take more than 20 years for the Toronto Blue Jays to recover. So baseball was in a terrible spot after that labor stoppage.
So compare that to the mood of fans watching McGuire and Sosa when they started to chase down Maris. Buster, you were covering the Yankees at the time. What was the vibe like that summer?
A lot of excitement. Those two guys captured the imagination of baseball fans and also other players. You know, that's what was so striking to go into the Yankees clubhouse. The Cubs often would be playing in the afternoon, and to see all the players stopping and making a point to watch Sammy's at bats, and then after games going to the clubhouse, and the Cardinals would still be going on someplace, and again the players would be locked into their at bats. You know, just in talking with players recently who experienced it that summer, they referenced that. It was like everything stopped when those guys came to the plate. That wasn't only for players, of course. It was for fans across the country.
You have a story out today where you spoke to a handful of pitchers who gave up home runs to both McGuire and Sosa in 1998. What was the unifying theme with them?
Well, Mina, the cool thing is I talked to five pitchers who allowed those home runs to both guys. To hear them speak honestly about their awe of those two hitters was pretty cool. For example, Rick Reed, who was a pitcher on the Mets, told me that every time McGuire got into the plate, his thinking was, my God, that guy is King Kong. And his thought was, please don't hit a line drive back through the middle. Please don't hit a line drive back through the middle. And I asked him, I said, does that mean you didn't want to pitch the outside corner? He said, absolutely. Other pitchers mentioned that too, that there was that fear of those two guys that year. Jim Parquet made his debut with the Chicago White Sox in 1998. The first two home runs that he allowed in his major league career were in June to McGuire and to Sosa.
Fly ball center field. Watch this one. Leave the ballpark. Number 30 for Mark McGuire.
And he talks about how now, when he has a better understanding of hitting because he works in player development, he really begins to see just how great those guys were back then. That summer, both of them, who at times you could get Mark McGuire to chase at high fastballs. Before that, you could get Sammy Sosa to chase breaking balls off the outside corner. That summer, they were completely locked in.
So on the other side, how did Mark and Sammy handle the pressure of chasing down Roger Maris?
And Mina, in the middle of that year, the New York Times sent me to go out and do a story on McGuire and the whole thing that was going on with the batting practice and the level of excitement there was for fans to come out and to watch batting practice. And again, it wasn't only the fans were excited, but players were very excited. Rick Reed talking about how he'd fight his way out of the house early to make sure that he'd go out and watch every bit of batting practice for both of those guys. But it really struck me when I was around McGuire how onerous this all was on him. Like the attention and having to deal with crowds of knuckleheads like me, like that really wore on him.
I remember being swarmed. I'd probably say maybe 60 reporters like in a circle around me. And I remember making the comment and just in jest, like, God, I feel like a caged animal.
He was absolutely joyless before games. What I heard from Andy Bennis, who was one of his teammates the year before and the year after that, was that was difficult for him. And it wasn't until he was on the field that McGuire was really freed up. And the interesting thing, of course, is as that played out, Sammy was the one who really drew McGuire out of his shell. Because Sammy always had fun when he played. You know, the hop out of the box when he knew he hit a ball well, the smile. Sammy really pulled McGuire out of that, you know, feeling of heaviness as his chase went down.
So finally, on September 8th, 1998, my 13th birthday, I remember it very vividly. Sorry, Buster. Mark McGuire passed Roger Maris and became the single season home run king, ironically, against the Cubs and Sosa. What happened?
It was interesting because, of course, McGuire all year, you watch his at-bats, I mean, he was hitting his moonshots. And it turns out that the record breaker was a line drive off Steve Traxel right down the left field line.
Swing and a shot into the corner. It might make it. There it is. 62, folks. Just got over the left field wall. And we have a new home run champion.
When he first hit it, he didn't think it was going to be a home run. But when it clears the fence, then everything erupts. Like, McGuire is so excited, he almost misses first base, and Dave McKay, the first base coach, has to pull him back. And that rest of that game became a celebration between Sammy and between McGuire. You know, we have some old school holdouts in baseball now. Back then, you didn't see that. Like, you didn't see players on opposite teams celebrating the fraternization during the game in the way that you see some of it now. And that's what was so striking at that time, was the absolute joy, which McGuire really hadn't exuded at all that year, came spilling out of him, and that was really cool.
All my family, everybody, Chicago Cubs, Sammy Sosa, unbelievable. Claps. Thank you, St. Louis.
All right, after the break, let's talk about the darker side of that summer and what we've learned about it since. Hi guys, given everything that is happening in the world right now, most of us are buying things online. I saw that AT&T started doing two really helpful things for those who want to buy a new phone or device online. They are offering fast, free, non-contact delivery and curbside pickup so that online shopping is as simple and safe as possible. On top of that, they have a flexible return policy so you can shop at ease. You can visit att.com to learn how to shop online from the safety of your home 24/7. Subject to change, restrictions apply. Buster, obviously there's another side to the story. Both of these sluggers had their accomplishments tainted publicly as a result of the role that performance-enhancing substances played, not just for them, but in Major League Baseball as a whole. At the time, that wasn't a concern. What impact did their season have on baseball back then?
It certainly helped to bring fans back into the ballparks. There's no question about it. Look, in the steroid era, the home run numbers absolutely exploded. You know, not only for stars like McGuire and Sosa, but you start to see middle infielders, scrawny middle infielders, show up in spring training, very muscle-bound, and they were hitting 25 or 30 home runs. You know, you had the commercials, which I'm sure you remember, you know, Chicks Dig the Long Ball, where you had Tom Glavine and Greg Maddux of the Braves trying to beef up their home run power in their workouts. Baseball played to it because they could tell that fans responded to it so well.
In 2006, you wrote an op-ed where you called the steroid era an institutional failure for Major League Baseball. And Buster, you even took some responsibility for it, saying you and the rest of the media knew what was going on. How did every aspect of baseball fail back then?
Yeah, and it really was. I call it, you know, the triangle of blame. The Players Association was the most powerful entity in the game. You had a lot of clean players behind the scenes who were upset by what they were seeing, and their voices really wouldn't manifest until they forced the leadership of the union in 2002 to agree to testing. Bud Selig could have done more as commissioner. And I mentioned the writers, like myself, who covered the sport. You know, we failed to address it in the way that we should have. And it was interesting because there's a perception that in 98, the party was rolling and the writers didn't want to get in the way. I mean, we don't know each other very well. I can tell you right now, if I could have broken that story, I would have loved to have. In fact, I had conversations with my sports editor at the Baltimore Sun, Jack Gibbons, Neil Andrews, my sports editor at the New York Times. We would talk all the time, how do we get at this story? And we focus so much on how do we get a player to admit it? Or do we get, you know, an ex-wife, an ex-trainer, a teammate who comes out and says something about a player using? And too late for me, but I realized in 2002 that whole time I should have been getting a lot of observations from other players generally talking about how steroid use had exploded. In other words, rather than focusing just trying to get one player to admit it or the story of one player having used steroids, just get players to talk about what they were seeing. In 1995, Tony Gwynn of the San Diego Padres, Frank Thomas of the White Sox came out and in the Los Angeles Times story, and they spoke generally about, you know what, there's a problem here and we're seeing it and the problem is growing. That's what I should have really been focused on as a reporter rather than getting hung up and trying to get the goods on one player in particular.
Buster, there are players who were potentially guilty of taking performance-enhancing substances and managers who benefited from their success who are in the Hall of Fame today. But neither McGuire nor Sosa have come close to the threshold needed to get into Cooperstown. Why do you think they're specifically marked for punishment?
Because they were the best players. Like, I find it laughable to the point that I stopped voting for the Hall of Fame because I thought it was so absurd. You have the, you know, retroactive morality police among the baseball writers saying, oh, we can't, it's a house of the holy in Cooperstown. You can't let him in the Hall of Fame because we don't want steroid users. Are you kidding? When I interviewed Andy Benes, who allowed home runs to both those guys that year, he mentioned that there are already PED users in the Hall of Fame, and everybody knows it, who was in the game at that time. They were literally, and I don't know exactly who was using it and who wasn't using it, but I suspect that there were thousands of players under the baseball umbrella, college players, minor leaguers, big leaguers, who were using some form of PEDs during that time. And because Mark McGuire and Sammy Sosa and Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds, they had the biggest, gaudiest numbers on the back of their baseball cards, they caught the most scrutiny. It is kind of remarkable how some players who have been put in the Hall of Fame, among their peers, everyone is like, yeah, that guy used. And that guy used. We know that guy used. And yet the focus has been on such a small handful of people. You know, my objection with the writers is by focusing on one player, they're taking the issue completely out of context for how widespread the use was at that time.
It's interesting to hear you quote Andy Benes there, because I was going to ask, you know, you talked to these pitchers about what it was like to play these guys and the commonalities between them. How do they feel about what they know now, or I suppose might have known then?
Yeah, and there was a range of opinion. Like Andy Benes, his feeling is, you know what, it doesn't bother me. Rick Reed said he doesn't feel cheated. Now, he also added, you know, those guys did what they did, and they have to live with the ramifications. Willie Blair talked about how when he was younger, when he was playing, it bothered him, and he was more outspoken. But as time has gone on, he's at peace with it because he feels like, you know what, that's just what the game was at that time. I've had players who I didn't speak with for this article, but over the last 10, 12 years, they speak with anger about that time because they made the choice not to use, and they feel like, you know what, there's no question that the players who used gained an advantage. In fact, Jason Barre, one of the guys I talked to for this story, talked about, and he mentioned, he said, you know, I didn't do it. I don't agree with it. I don't think it was the right thing. And while he's not angry at those guys, he also says the results would have been different. There's no doubt about that. You can't really assess what the numbers would be, but they would be different.
Undoubtedly, the chase impacted the game and its history. Buster, how did it change the way fans saw it, young fans in particular?
You know, fans now look at that time completely differently than they did 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And I know this because when I, for example, will send out tweets mentioning that the show is coming on Sunday night, it's remarkable to me how so many of the responses are, you know, hypodermic needles sent back in tweets. Let's keep in mind, you know, in part because of what happened in 98 and the fact that people assume that steroids were involved with Sammy Sosa, that's part of the reason why he has been persona non grata with the Chicago Cubs for so long. Mark McGuire, the reason why he eventually came out and acknowledged using after saying in front of Congress, you know, I'm not here to talk about the past, was the feeling that he needed to come out and admit something before he would be allowed to be an employee with the St. Louis Cardinals. So while their accomplishments were celebrated widely in 98, inside the sport, outside the sport, I don't think they are now. And that's the same type of response that I get if you mention a Barry Bonds, you mention a Roger Clemens.
So 22 years later, as we consider a baseball season on the brink, and what happened before the chase, Do you think ultimately it was good for baseball or bad for the sport?
I think it certainly helped baseball in that moment. I think the failure for the institution of baseball, and I put the dirty players in that, I put the clean players in that, the union leadership, the commissioner of baseball, writers like myself to deal with it, ultimately hurt the sport because you don't want fans to be asking the question, was that real? I just saw a guy hit 70 home runs. Was that real? I just saw Barry Bonds hit 73 home runs. Was that real? It's the same sort of questions being asked about the Houston Astros in the aftermath of the sign stealing scandal. That is a dangerous thing for the sport to have. You cannot have a situation where the integrity of the results in the field are undercut. And there's no question people look back at that time and wonder what was real, including some of the players.
All right, Buster, hopefully next time I have you on, it's to talk about baseball returning. And if you're listening, stop asking him, guys. We don't know yet.
Thanks, Mina.
Coming up, a signature sneaker that's 23 years in the making. We're presented by Marathon. Now more than ever, we have to look out for each other and count on each other. And Marathon wants you to know that you can count on them for high-quality, top-tier gas. While we're aware travel may not be top of mind, there might be times where you have to hop into the car to run an errand. Or maybe you just want to drive to see your best friend, simply to wave from a safe distance. But before you head out, remember to fuel up at Marathon. And right now, you can get 5 cents off every gallon every day with Make It Count rewards from Marathon. Plus, you can earn points for additional savings on fuel, airfare, hotels, and more. This is definitely a deal you can count on. It's also quick and easy to join. Just download the free Make It Count app or go to makeitcount.com/radio and start saving today. This offer is valid only at participating Marathon stations. Remember, wherever you need to go, the people at Marathon are behind you all the way. Marathon, fueling the American spirit. Here's another story I want you to know. It's been 23 years since God Sham God became a household name when the world bore witness to the crossover move, that's how named after him, during the NCAA tournament. Since then, his career in basketball has taken him to the NBA, then China, then back to Providence College, where he returned as a student in 2012 to finish his degree. He is now back in the NBA, where he's an assistant coach with the Dallas Mavericks. And at the age of 44 years old, he finally has a signature shoe. This week, Puma unveiled the Legacy Sham God, a black, red, and white sneaker with extra ankle support. Sham God told the New York Post, "When I was a kid, having your own sneaker was a fantasy. That's why it's so amazing that it's happening now." His playing days are over, of course, but given that he's still a part of the league and his team, Dallas, will be playing in the reduced NBA season, we might get to see the Sham Gods on the sidelines in Orlando, bringing things full circle for a player whose impact has long exceeded his time on the court. I'm Mina Kimes, and this has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Steve Martin, Ryan Nantel, Wendy Tennant, Eve Tro, Chris Tuminello, and Aaron Vail. Special thanks this week to Bradford Craig, Russell Donalo, Josh Dye, Troy Farkas, Mia Posmenter, and Eve Wolf. I'll talk to you Monday.